Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello and welcome to Interchange. My name's Dave Stewart, and it is my great pleasure today to have as my guest Linda Charnas, Professor of English at Indiana University. Professor Charnas, welcome to Interchange.
Thanks very much, Dave, for inviting me to talk this morning, and please call me Linda.
Linda, this is the first Tuesday in February 2011, and you teach about Shakespeare. My first question is Shakespeare relevant today?
You know, Dave, I would be tempted to reformulate that question and say, in what way is Shakespeare not relevant today? One of the things that's so surprising about our culture as a Shakespearean is I'm aware of all the different ways Shakespeare has filtered in to storylines, plot lines. Young people can hardly go to the movies these days without seeing versions of Shakespeare plays presented to them, such as, say, 10 Things That I Hate About You. It may sound like a long time ago, 400 years, but in a way, everything Shakespeare is doing is setting the ground for the modernity that we are going to inherit. So yes, 400 years is a long time ago. On the other hand, it's just like it was yesterday.
Now, when you say the movie 10 Things I Hate About You, what Shakespeare play was that based on?
That was based on The Taming of the Shrew, which seems to be a perennial favorite because people think about it as the kind of classic Shakespearean romp about the war between the sexes. It's actually a very cruel play, and we can talk about that later, but it tends to be one of the favorites that's brought back out for repackaging. As well, think about the current vampire stories, the love stories between humans and vampires. Think about the Twilight series. Those are all basically based on Romeo and Juliet, the story of star-crossed love, in this case between a vampire and a human.
Okay, now, when we talk about Shakespeare, the idea of reading a Shakespeare play intimidates some people. What would you say to them?
I would say that they're right to be intimidated in a way, because reading the plays is not the primary thing that Shakespeare had in mind when he wrote them. They were written as play texts to be performed in a theater with costumes and gestures, largely for a mixed audience, many of whom would have been illiterate. So Shakespeare didn't write the plays as great literature. He wrote them as performance pieces, which makes it much more of a challenge, I think, for somebody to sit quietly at home alone reading a play.
Now, when you say Shakespeare was written for the vast majority of people, was Shakespeare popular in his day?
Yes, he was popular in his day. He was very well thought of. He became more popular later in his career. Initially, he provoked the ire of some of his contemporaries. He was famously called by the playwright Robert Greene the upstart crow. People were angry at this young nobody who came in and started writing really popular plays. But by the time he died, it was Ben Jonson, another one of his contemporaries, who wrote the epitaph that is on the first page of the first folio.
Which is?
The first folio is the first collected printed edition of Shakespeare's works in their entirety. It was published in 1623, 7 years after Shakespeare's death. And this tells you a lot about his popularity, the fact that his colleagues, Hemings and Condell, believed that they could make enough money by collecting all of the plays and printing them up as one volume, which would have been very expensive. The fact that they knew that they could make some profit off of that is a testimony to Shakespeare's popularity.
Now, before we get in and talk about the specifics of some Shakespeare plays, I'd like to talk about the Department of English just a little bit. Why do people take English? Why do people major in English?
That's a very complicated and interesting question. I think that if you were to ask English majors who are just declaring the major, many of them would say, well, because I love to read. Many people may begin the major thinking it's one of the easier majors, but by the time they get going in it, they realize that, in fact, it's probably one of the most challenging, difficult majors, because what it requires is reading challenging texts and learning about psychology, political science, history, literary aesthetics, but basically it's learning how to think critically and interpret human experience, and I would say that that's what English majors get out of the major.
Now, when we talk about Shakespeare was written 400 years ago. That's not so far in the past, but it is far enough in the past that a lot of things have happened in those 400 years. And when you talk about an English major, you're talking about a lot of people who are writing in the English language. How much has Shakespeare influenced later writing?
Shakespeare's influence has been enormous, absolutely enormous. I would say that just about every great writer in English has felt him or herself to be writing to some extent in Shakespeare's shadow, whether it's John Milton or Jane Austen or James Joyce, Charles Dickens, Don DeLillo. The list is endless. Virginia Woolf. Shakespeare is everywhere. He is a force to be reckoned with.
You mentioned Milton. Why is Milton important?
Well, starting in the context of Shakespeare's influence on Milton, Milton takes 10 lines from Genesis in the scripture, and he expands it into a 12-book epic poem about the fall of man, and surprisingly, and most importantly, about why the fall of man turned out to be a good thing. For me, I think that one of the reasons that Milton is so important is he offers an extremely nuanced and complex representation and understanding of what constitutes evil. And I think that this comes straight out of Shakespeare. We have a very, in some ways, black and white notion of what evil is. But for Shakespeare, evil is something that occupies the gray area of human conduct. And Paradise Lost, Milton gives us one of the greatest epic figures in all of literature, the figure of Satan. And Milton's Satan is a profoundly human, deeply understandable, in many ways very sympathetic figure. And through getting to know the figure of Satan in Paradise Lost, we learn the most important lesson, I think, about evil that Milton wants to teach us, which is how easy it would be for all of us to be evil if we're not very careful about how we manage our own egos.
Okay, now that seems to be almost like a tragedy. When a lot of people think about Shakespeare, they think about tragedies. What's the connection there?
The classical notion of tragedy involves a figure in a high position, a figure in a position of power, a king, falling, being murdered or being humiliated, being thrown out of a high place. I think that one of the things that's extraordinary about Shakespeare is his theorizing of evil as a series almost of minor missteps that people can make that they then bunker in around. For instance, let's say that somebody falsely accuses his or her wife of infidelity. Even as the evidence increasingly proves that to be wrong, this figure, let's say Othello, cannot backpedal away from that accusation. And I think that for Shakespeare, the road to evil is a road. It has stopping points and starting points. Characters get started in certain directions and just find themselves inexplicably unable to stop. And this is where Milton picks up with the figure of Satan. He's angry at God. He's angry at God, and he can't stop being angry at God. So in a way, the figure of evil in Paradise Lost is a person who doesn't know how to manage his own anger, and that is very human.
This is Interchange, and I'm here with Linda Charnas of the Department of English at Indiana University. Linda, how do you choose which Shakespeare plays to teach?
When I teach Shakespeare in an undergraduate class, I usually teach only 6 or 7 plays during the course of a 15-week semester. People have asked me why so few plays. To my mind, actually, it's an incredible challenge teaching 6 or 7 plays over the course of 15 weeks. I tend to choose the plays that I believe most represent what's unique about Shakespeare, and they tend to be the plays that are not necessarily taught in high school. They're the plays that involve a lot more moral gray area and a lot more complexity and a lot more difficult issues to confront. I'll usually teach Othello, Merchant of Venice, King Lear. I will teach some of the history plays. These let me bring up issues in class that I think are relevant to my students' lives, and that includes confronting issues of racism, anti-Semitism, questions of self-confidence with a figure like Othello, who's an extraordinary general, but he's a black Moor. Nothing that he manages to do can convince him that he's acceptable in spite of his race. And I find that my students can connect in very well with the more complicated plays of Shakespeare. But by that same token, because they're so complex, each play really requires about 3 weeks to do the job right.
I'd like to ask, you didn't mention some of the most popular plays, such as Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar. Why don't you teach those?
I usually don't teach those, it's true. And I think that partly it's because I assume that many of my students have encountered those plays in the high school classroom. I also think that those are the plays that can be most easily reduced to certain takeaway sound bites. And I really like to get into the messier, more complicated Shakespeare plays. I find that they tend to fascinate my students on a much deeper level.
Now, when we talk about Shakespeare, you've mentioned the plays, I actually mentioned the more popular plays, then you mentioned the more difficult plays. Is it true that you can get a greater understanding of Shakespeare if you read all the plays?
Yes, I do think that you can get a greater understanding if you read all of the plays. I wish in a perfect world that it would be possible to do an English degree that was 4 years of just studying Shakespeare. That would actually be my idea of heaven. I think that even if you didn't know much about Shakespeare's historical context, certainly if you were to read all of the plays through from start to finish, what you would come away with is a very clear sense of the issues that obsessed Shakespeare, the issues that he returns to over and over and over again. So anybody who wants to read Shakespeare outside of the classroom, I think that it's a doable and very worthwhile undertaking.
And when you say the issues that Shakespeare returns to again and again, what are those, please?
They're the issues of family conflict, intergenerational conflict, gender and sexual conflict, gender identity and sexual roles, power politics. Shakespeare was a brilliant theoretician of power and its complexities. And most importantly, the psychological issues of self-esteem, how to handle conflict, even within yourself and among others. Issues that never change over time. They remain constant.
When we mention time, things were vastly different 400 years ago. There was no internet, no TV. So put Shakespeare's time frame into context for me, please.
When Shakespeare was writing, probably roughly two-thirds of his audience would have been illiterate. And so the theater served the purpose that television for us serves today, newspapers. It was very expensive to buy books in Shakespeare's day. So most people would have gotten their information about the world and their own culture from the playhouse. And the playhouse was affordable. Let's say that you were somebody whose job was to ferry people across the Thames for half a day's wage, which sounds like a lot and probably was a lot to that person. You could go to the theater and find out what was happening in the time. Shakespeare's culture was extremely different from our own. He was writing under Queen Elizabeth, and the doctrine of the divine right of kings was still in place. And of course, we live in a democracy, and the idea of monarchs and kings is absurd to us. So in that regard, 400 years ago is a very long time indeed.
So please do talk about Queen Elizabeth.
One of the most remarkable things about Shakespeare's culture is that for 45 years, England was ruled by a woman. Queen Elizabeth. She never married, for obvious reasons, given that her father was Henry VIII, and she didn't have children. She was not willing to give up her power, and she knew that if she were to marry, she would be giving up her power to her husband. Shakespeare's plays are full of female characters who seem to be aware of the loss of power that comes with marrying. At the same time, Queen Elizabeth was no feminist. She was the exception that proved the rule. Women in Shakespeare's day were the property of their fathers and their husbands, and they had no separate legal identities. That was very paradoxical, given that England was being ruled by a woman for 45 years.
So Shakespeare wrote historical plays. Why was the audience in Shakespeare's time so interested in political questions and wars?
Political questions are inseparable from everyday life in Shakespeare. There's no separation. We tend in our culture today to separate out categories. There are sociological issues, economic issues, political, religious, familial, domestic. None of these categories really existed as separate spheres for Shakespeare. It was very interwoven. The plays also became the kind of chronicle of the times. How did people learn their history when they couldn't read in Shakespeare's day? They would go to the theater and they would see history plays, which isn't to say that the history plays were presenting real history, but they were repackaging the history that Shakespeare himself had read in the chronicles. And this is the way that people learned about their world and their culture.
Totally fascinating. This is Interchange. I'm with Linda Charnas, professor of English at Indiana University. We're heading into our first break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about the plays of Shakespeare. Welcome back to Interchange. My name's Dave Stewart. It is my pleasure to be here with Professor Linda Charnas of the Department of English at Indiana University. We've been talking about Shakespeare, and we've been talking about how in the past people would go to plays in Shakespeare's time and go to plays as a way of, like a newspaper, the Times, and how political issues were not separated from other issues, but it was all connected. Was Shakespeare politically correct?
Well, Shakespeare was mostly politically correct in his own time, and the ways in which he was not politically correct were fairly sneaky. In our time, I would say that Shakespeare is absolutely not politically correct, and that's one of the reasons why often in the high school classroom and very frequently in the history of editing Shakespeare, some of the most politically incorrect details have been edited out. The history of editing Shakespeare is a really fascinating history of exactly this question of editors who have thought, oh, this particular line is unacceptable, it's too racist, this particular dirty joke is unacceptable, it's too vulgar, a history of cleaning up Shakespeare to make him more politically correct. Not unlike, I think, what that new edition of Huck Finn is aiming to do in its substitution of the word slave for the word nigger that Twain uses some 100-150 times. Editors decide something is simply politically unacceptable, and so the history of editing Shakespeare has often been a history of trying to, quote-unquote, clean him up. But Shakespeare was actually very politically incorrect in all kinds of ways that we would think now.
Can you give me an example?
Well, The Merchant of Venice. Of course, the figure of Shylock is, in a way, the great prototype of the Jew that, of course, figures like Dickens are going to use later with the figure of Fagin, the money-grubbing Jew, is really a figure that Shakespeare develops in Merchant of Venice. However, that said, he's not content to simply turn Shylock into a kind of stereotype. He also shows the way in which Shylock's activities are so marginalized by the state that he's living in that he's left very little alternative to what he's doing. So that's what I meant when I said that Shakespeare is both politically incorrect and politically correct in his own time. On the one hand, he's demonizing the Jew. On the other hand, he's humanizing the Jew. Both things are true about Shakespeare.
Can you give me examples of how Shakespeare both demonizes and humanizes Shylock?
Shylock is the moneylender in The Merchant of Venice, and two Christians in the play come to him. They need to borrow money. Shylock is furious because of the way that he's been treated, and he lets them know exactly what he's so angry about. Later on in the play, however, they've pushed him to the point where he actually does want his pound of flesh. So what begins as kind of an effort to humiliate the merchant symbolically becomes something more bloodthirsty. Shakespeare shows us the process through which somebody who is merely angry, and understandably so, can turn into somebody who is bloodthirsty in ways that go beyond all reason.
And this gets back to what you said earlier about how evil is just a series of small little steps.
Yes, Shakespeare really shows this. People are never evil without having a context in Shakespeare's plays. We don't see pure psychopaths in Shakespeare's plays, or sometimes we see sociopaths like the figure of Iago in Othello. But more commonly in Shakespeare, figures who become bad for one reason or another are often socially marginalized figures. The figure like the bastard son in King Lear, the figure of the Jew who is marginalized, the figure of the African Moor, Othello, who tries desperately to fit in but ultimately is not allowed to fit in, and he ends up doing some pretty bad things. Shakespeare shows us that being good or being evil is a series of small steps, and that we don't take them alone. We take them always in the interlocutorship of other people.
When we talk about how these small steps are taken, small steps taken by maybe me is not very meaningful, but a small step taken by a king is a lot more meaningful. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Shakespeare wrote these historical plays. Mm-hmm. Now, let's go... I guess we could start at the very beginning. Well, where would you start in talking about the historical plays, Professor Linda Charnas?
Well, that's a fantastic question, because I think that the figure of Richard II in the play of that name is an ideal example of this. Richard II is a king who takes the doctrine of the divine right of kings too literally. He believes he can do whatever he wants. He pushes the nobles around. He seizes estates. He's warned by others to stop doing this. He's repeatedly warned, if you do this, things are going to get very bad for you. But his ego gets in the way. He won't let himself be checked or corrected. And he takes a series of steps that do, in fact, result in him being usurped and overthrown, which is a terrible thing under the doctrine of the divine right of kings. But in the figure of Richard, we see a character who could have done things differently, was warned to do things differently, and refused to do things differently because he thought he could do no wrong. And so what happens to him is very much a function of his own personality.
Probably I might be wrong, but I would think that the historical play that most people are familiar with is Henry V. It has some of the greatest speeches ever written in the English language.
Yes.
Could you please talk about Henry V, and maybe you'd
yes.
like to go back to Henry IV?
Yeah. Henry V is an absolutely fascinating play, and in the context of the four plays that make up that group, which is known as the Henriad, it's an extremely cagey way for Shakespeare to end that group of plays. Richard II is a play about a king who is usurped, rightly and wrongly. His usurper becomes Henry IV. And what Henry IV learns is that unless you can provide an alternate ideology, an alternate doctrine for your subjects to believe in, you're going to find yourself pretty much back in the same position as the guy you usurped, which is exactly where Henry IV finds himself. He's there spouting the doctrine of the divine right of kings. The problem is nobody believes in it anymore. By the time he dies, and his son, the erstwhile Prince Hal, takes the throne as King Henry V, this kid has learned from his father's mistakes. While his father was usurping Richard II, Prince Hal was busy pub crawling and hanging out with the lowlifes. But he was watching very carefully, and he learned that the best way to rule is not to stand on high and spout the doctrine of divine right, but to learn how everybody speaks and thinks from the ground up. Henry V is a really brilliant play, because on the one hand, it is the source of the most stunning and effective propaganda speeches. On the other, it's Shakespeare showing us exactly how propaganda works. So it's not possible to say that Henry V is a play that is pro-war and pro-monarchy. Its propagandistic speeches are, but then you go into other scenes in the play and it clearly shows that those speeches are just that, propaganda.
Now, Linda, can you please go in and give me an example of some of the ways, or a way that Shakespeare would show that some of those speeches are, and please give some context for people who might not have read Henry V.
Richard II is a play about what goes wrong when politics operate from the top down. The two parts of Henry IV show what happens when you just take those politics and try to do them exactly the same way, this time with somebody else's king. By the time we get to Henry V, King Henry, or King Harry as he likes to be known, understands that top-down politics is not going to win the hearts and minds of his subjects. It's not going to get them to fight for him. He understands that he has to appeal to them more as brothers. And of course, we have that famous, we few, we marry few, we band of brothers. That's the famous St. Crispin's Day speech that Harry delivers to his troops before the battle at Agincourt. On the one hand, one wants to say, yes, these are extremely powerful and moving speeches, and they are. And whenever I read them to my students, I find myself feeling intensely patriotic. It takes over. It happens in spite of you. But then, after those speeches, Shakespeare takes us to scenes where the little guys are saying, I would rather be up to my waist in the frozen Thames than here fighting this battle. So we veer wildly in Henry V from these feelings of immense patriotism that are brought about by these extraordinary speeches to what it's really like for the poor foot soldiers on the ground. And it's terrible. And Shakespeare does both things. And I think the fact that he's doing both things, he's both showing us how patriotism is generated, how it's manufactured, on the one hand, A, and B, on the other hand, showing us how it fails. How propaganda fails and the ideology fails is the most interesting lesson to be learned in Henry V. Shakespeare is showing us both things.
So Shakespeare is kind of ambiguous. Is Shakespeare deliberately ambiguous?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Shakespeare was intensely ambivalent. When I think about what it is that's extraordinary about Shakespeare as a writer and the way that his mind works, I think that just naturally he goes to the places of paradox and contradiction, of ambiguity and ambivalence. If there is a way to contradict a proposition, Shakespeare will build it into his play, either in the form of characters or in the form of events. Yes, Henry V's speeches are very rousing and very effective as set pieces for the audience. However, they're not terribly effective for the poor guys who have to go out. They're hungry, they're cold, they're tired. They have to go out and fight the French in a battle that has nothing to do with them. And Shakespeare will always show us both things.
Okay, this is Interchange. I'm here with Professor Linda Charnas of the Department of English at Indiana University. Let's go back to Henry IV. You mentioned that Henry was hanging out with the lowlifes. Now, I've read Henry IV. In fact, that was the first historical play that I read. I really enjoyed it. I'd recommend it to anyone, Henry IV, Part 1. But when you say lowlifes, you're talking about Falstaff and Pistol. Can you please talk about those characters? And if there's anything ambivalent, those guys can either be lowlifes or they can be the best buddies you could ever have.
Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic question. And you're absolutely right. And I'm glad that you called me to speak to that. The figure of Falstaff's a really interesting one. Hugely popular. In fact, he was so popular that even after Shakespeare killed him off, he brought him back in Merry Wives of Windsor because the audience wanted to see him again. Falstaff is what would have been known as a cash-poor nobleman in the play. Yes, he came from a landed family at one time, but he's fallen on hard times financially. He's a thief. He's a glutton. He's a hanger-on. Yes, he's a great friend to Hal, who is hanging out with him, but he's also expecting Hal to become a cash cow. The thing to remember about Hal, everybody calls him Prince Hal, he wasn't born a prince. His father was a usurper. Henry IV usurped the throne from Richard II, which means that Hal only became a prince when his father successfully usurped Richard II. And this is where the moral ambiguity lies. So Hal, in a sense, you could say that he was hanging out, going undercover with the lowlifes. It is true that the tavern scenes and the scenes in Eastcheap, which are among the funniest and most famous in 1 Henry IV, are wonderfully entertaining. And the characters in those scenes are fantastic people. It's also true that Prince Hal himself says that he's only hanging out with them to use them.
And actually, instead of going undercover, that's who he is, because he would have been hanging out with them had his father not usurped the throne.
I'm not sure that that's true. I just don't know. Shakespeare doesn't give us to know that. He is introduced to us only when his father mentions him at the end of Richard II. He says, "Can no man tell me of my unthrifty son?" And lo and behold, where was Bolingbroke's firstborn son when he was busy usurping the throne from Richard II? Nowhere to be found except in the pubs of Eastcheap. So we don't know whether he would have been hanging out there or not. It's very hard to know. We do know that by the time we meet him at the beginning of 1 Henry IV, his palling around with these guys is strategic. He himself says so.
Okay. Now, then getting into, like, you've got Falstaff, a great character. You've got another character, Pistol. And when you say it's strategic, he's hanging around with them to learn how the people talk so that he can motivate them later. Is that correct? But also, you have that great question of Pistol, who says, "Hal, when you're king, would you hang a thief?" Mm. And Hal says, "No, you will hang a thief." Mm. And later, Pistol does steal from a church, and Henry does hang him. This line, that's really ambiguous and could be, isn't that some of the brilliancy of the use of the language of
Yes.
Shakespeare?
Yes, it is. And in that line, Shakespeare is foreshadowing. The people that Hal hangs out with, they become a part of the problem in Henry V. And it is true that one of his former buddies, Bardolph, is going to be hanged in Henry V, but he's going to be hanged for a petty theft. And it's going to be Lieutenant Pistol who has to make sure that he is hanged.
Oh, I see. This is Interchange. I'm here with Professor Linda Charnas of the Department of English. And when we come back, we will continue talking about the Shakespeare plays. Welcome back to Interchange. My name's Dave Stewart. It has been my pleasure to be talking here with Professor Linda Charnas of the Department of English here at Indiana University, and we've been talking about Shakespeare plays. We kind of, in the last segment, talked about how Shakespeare is deliberately ambiguous, how Shakespeare in the historical plays gives us a kind of a narrative, and the narrative is what people went to the plays at that time to kind of know what's going on in the times. And Shakespeare would provide almost two points of view and make us decide what is really the truth, what's the lesson to be learned. So there's no real stock answer that can be taken out of a Shakespeare play, but it is something that you could maybe read over and over and over and discuss with others and gain knowledge into like the human experience. But when we talk about the human experience, then we have to realize that Shakespeare was human. And there's some controversy over, well, did Shakespeare write the Shakespeare plays? I'd like to ask you, who was Shakespeare? And did he write the plays?
Well, that's a question that I was speaking with my class about just last week. I would say that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare, and I think that most Shakespeare scholars who are actually professional Shakespeare scholars would agree with me. But I think that the question is an interesting one, and I don't want to be too dismissive about it. The whole authorship question, I think, really has arisen out of a sense that somebody of Shakespeare's humble class beginnings and relatively mediocre education could not possibly have understood as much about the intricacies of court life and power, what was actually involved in being a king. There's no evidence that Shakespeare was particularly well-traveled. These are the elements that people who like to claim other authorship usually seize on. How could Shakespeare have known about these things? On the one hand, one wants to say, sure, that's understandable to have that question. On the other, I think there's a certain elitism behind the question that the Shakespeare plays could only have been written by a nobleman. That's where the theory that the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays comes in. And I think that that really downplays the degree to which Shakespeare's mind was how do I want to put this? I think he functioned almost like a cultural filter. I wouldn't say that he was able to write these plays because he knew about all of these things. I think he understood certain basic human dynamics about power and then was able to make a lot of things up. But the people who argue for other authors really are making that argument on the basis of judgments about Shakespeare's education.
And when you talk about his class, Shakespeare's class, his origins as relatively middle class or lower middle class, then that brings up the question of, well, what was the class situation back 400 years ago? I really don't know.
Yeah. It was a very, very tumultuous and shifting time in terms of the economy. But one of the cliches that is also true about the time is that Shakespeare wrote during the first emergence of a middle class in England. It became possible really for the first time in English history for people to change their status through their own efforts. Shakespeare was a self-made man, very much a self-made man. He was the son of a leather worker, a glovier. His father was not impoverished, but he was an artisan, a craftsman, a blue-collar type, we would say, I suppose. And Shakespeare did get a fairly normal education, but through his own efforts at playwriting, he managed to make enough money eventually to buy stock in the Globe Theater, and he was able to purchase a coat of arms for his family and a fairly modest estate at Stratford and die something of a gentleman. So Shakespeare himself was obsessed with issues of class and social mobility. And it's one of the things that make his plays still relevant today, I think, because especially for we Americans, we have a very uneasy relationship to class and status. We like to pretend that there are no such thing as such concerns in this country, but there are. And I think that Shakespeare's plays are a great way of helping us to understand our own investments in changing our own social status.
And hopefully changing it for the better.
One would hope for the better. Certainly, Shakespeare knew what it was like to come from very humble beginnings and to become extremely successful in ways that would have been absolutely unimaginable, I think, 100 years earlier.
And then as we talk about how Shakespeare was middle class, how there is an emerging middle class, how middle class was attempting to rise, and you do try to rise higher, Then that gets back again to the question about who the plays were written for. And even though now you think, oh, a Shakespeare play, it's so elitist, but it wasn't. At the time, it was written for the common man as a way for them to learn how. And when you talk about the common man, you can't have a tragedy all the time. In fact, there has to be some sort of counterpoint to it, and the counterpoint might be comedy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that maybe a lot of people who don't read Shakespeare don't realize, I certainly didn't, when I read my first Shakespeare play, I was amazed at how often I was putting it down and laughing. What makes Shakespeare so funny?
Well, first of all, Shakespeare understood how ridiculous people are when they, precisely when they want to be higher than they are. And so Shakespeare, often the butt of jokes in Shakespeare are people trying to rise above their station in life. People who take themselves too seriously, people who are pretentious are the endless butt of jokes in Shakespeare. With respect to his audience, I mean, there's been a lot of work done. Shakespeare's plays were absolutely not just for the elite in his day. In a way, his task was to write for the full range of people who could get into the Globe Playhouse. People could come in. It wasn't a nobles-only playhouse. If you could afford the price of a ticket, you could get in to see the play. So somehow Shakespeare had to produce plays that would appeal both to the nobility that was in the audience as well as the groundlings, the people who had paid a penny to get in and stand in the pit. And he managed to do that. And even in the tragedies, there will be interludes of humor. In fact, some of Shakespeare's most notorious villains are often extremely funny. The figure of Iago is very, very funny, I'm sorry to say, but it is true. He is.
Now, could you give me an example of who Iago is and why Iago, it could be funny? Just an example of a comedic aspect of Shakespeare.
Iago is the quote-unquote villain who takes down Othello by convincing him that his wife is unfaithful to him. But one of the things that Iago does is he cultivates people to do his dirty work for him. One of the ways that he does that is by playing on the greed of another character, Roderigo. And he keeps telling him to put money in his purse. Fill thy purse with money. Put money in your purse. Fill thy purse with money. He repeats it over and over again, making Roderigo's class aspirations the object of a kind of humor that everybody in the audience could laugh at.
Why would that be? Why would you laugh at that?
Well, I think that in Shakespeare's comedies in general, the things that are most funny are the vices that the audience shares. Everybody is concerned with bettering their station, but these often become the butt of the jokes. In a play like Twelfth Night, we have the figure of Malvolio. He's the house steward, the house servant, and he wants to marry the lady that he works for, but of course he's too low class to do so. And a joke is played on him, convincing him to dress up in a silly costume. And that will please her. And of course, this is just a joke. Nonetheless, he dresses up in this silly costume and everybody thinks it's funny. And the reason that they think it's funny is simply he's doing in an exaggerated way what everybody else in the play is doing.
Meaning?
Wanting to be somebody better than they are. Shakespeare's very ambivalent about this. Shakespeare himself is very invested in class status, but he's also very uncomfortable about that investment. And so many of the targets of Shakespearean comedy are abject social climbers.
Abject social climbers. Yeah. Okay, now, and that's another thing that I wanted to bring up, is Shakespeare was a man. I believe all the actors in the plays were men, correct?
Yeah.
And yet he has women, and Professor Linda Charnas, you have brought up earlier that the women at those times were almost like possessions of the husband. Mm-hmm. I mean, they did not have feminism or equal rights. Mm-hmm. And yet Shakespeare writes women mm-hmm. who make sense to other women. Is this one of the characteristics of Shakespeare that's extraordinary?
Yeah, it is remarkable. That's a great question. It's true that in Shakespeare's day, there were no female actors. So every role being played on the stage was being played by a man. The female characters would often be played by teenage boys. And so an audience going to see the play would be watching a male Romeo kissing a male Juliet in drag. So Shakespeare plays a lot with issues of gender. I think, in a way, the backdrop for a lot of this as well is the fact that Queen Elizabeth is on the throne. The way that Shakespeare writes female characters, though, and this gets to your question, is convincing. it is convincing to us. His female characters do seem female. When you read the plays, there's no doubt about that. Shakespeare was able to inhabit what it would have felt like, I think, to be a woman in his own time. And that's another thing that makes him great.
And to extrapolate from that point, Shakespeare has many different characters, and all of the characters seem to be believable. And then all of the characters seem to have different motivations. This is something extraordinary. There's no, each Shakespeare play seems to be quite different. And how does he get away with something like that? Mm.
I think that Shakespeare understood, and this is my opinion, that the idea of motivation is a much murkier thing than we realize. In a way, I would call motivation in a Shakespeare play distributed. No one character can be motivated and change everything that happens in the play. You have to have figures coming together, all of whom have motivations, and they form a collective kind of agency that makes things happen. A culture involves distributed agencies. And that's one of the reasons why it's very hard to blame a tragedy on one villain alone, or in a comedy to find one comic scapegoat alone who will carry all the blame. I don't think that Shakespeare really believed that a person's motivation operated in a vacuum. I think that for him, motivation was something that arose and changed, was shifted, was altered, and was ultimately only effective when it came into loggerheads with others.
And when we talk about how everything is connected, then it seems to be that you can say that everything's connected, we're all in it together, and also that maybe nothing is a stock answer. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you can read the plays many times, and each time gets something new, because there's not just one narrative thread. There's lots of different narrative threads. Mm-hmm. Now my question is, you teach Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Is there ever a case where maybe a young student, maybe a sophomore or something like that in college, might say something and it strikes you as something completely new?
Yes, absolutely. And I can give you a case in point. This is one of the reasons why I love teaching it. A few years ago, I had a female undergraduate who complained that I was being a little too hard on the character of Desdemona in Othello. I was pointing out that Desdemona bullies her husband and feels she can get away with it maybe because he's black. And the student said, "Professor Charnas, isn't Desdemona really just a young teenage girl, though, and she's led a very sheltered life, and would she even understand what it would mean to bully somebody? Aren't you being a little too hard on her?" And I realized that, of course, my student was right. And in successive classes, whenever we got to the issue of Desdemona and was she bullying Othello, I always tell my students about this correction that I was given because I think it's true. I need to remind myself often how naive the figure of Desdemona is. It's very easy to over-attribute motivation to her when in a way she was just a very sheltered young girl. This happens to me all the time. My students will bring things up that didn't occur to me and that change the way that I think about things. If it didn't, I wouldn't want to teach Shakespeare anymore. I've been doing it for 20 years and there's always something new that I learn. And I don't learn it on my own. I learn it only through teaching it in the classroom from my students.
Okay, Professor Lina Charnas, we've talked about a lot of aspects of Shakespeare. We've kind of jumped around from one play to another. As we near the end of this interview, is there anything that you'd like to say to somebody who perhaps has listened to this interview and might be thinking, you know, I should read a Shakespeare play? What would you encourage them to do?
I would encourage them, if they can, to take a class somewhere, whether it's whatever kind of class it is, because it's very difficult to get into a Shakespeare play and get everything that there is to get on your own. On the other hand, I think that if you read a number of plays together, the language gets much easier. If you could only choose a few plays of Shakespeare to read, I would say read Twelfth Night, because it's a wonderful comedy about gender. Read Othello, because it's an extraordinary meditation on cultural prejudice and what goes wrong when you fail to have enough belief in yourself. And read Hamlet, because it's the most famous play written in the English language.
Okay, well then, we've got about 2 minutes left, but let's do talk about Hamlet. To be or not to be. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. So can you just kind of give a synopsis on Hamlet?
Well, you know, at the end of class, when I'm done teaching Hamlet, I always ask my students, okay, how would you give a synopsis of Hamlet? This is exactly what I ask them. I say, put the plot of Hamlet in a nutshell. And there's always dead silence, because Hamlet is the longest play that Shakespeare wrote, the most complex play that Shakespeare wrote. And yet the revenge doesn't happen until the very end, which means that most of the action in Hamlet happens in Hamlet's head. It has to do with his psychology. It's almost impossible to give a synopsis of Hamlet. I can do it, and my students and I do it. We say, yeah, Hamlet comes back from school in Wittenberg to find out that his father has died, his mother has remarried his uncle. He learns from the ghost that his uncle killed his father, and then he takes revenge on his uncle. End of Hamlet. And when I say this to my students, they always laugh, because in fact, the great vast bulk of this nearly four-hour play is a kind of psychological quagmire of Hamlet trying to figure out why he doesn't haste him to his revenge. So it's almost impossible to give a synopsis of Hamlet. At the same time, everything that's worth knowing in Hamlet happens outside of the plot.
Outside of the plot? What do you mean by that?
I think that if the plot elements were the most important aspects of Shakespeare, everybody could understand what they needed to know simply by reading the Cliff Notes. And the truth of the matter is that you can read the Cliff Notes and it'll give you characters' names and the plot points, but it won't tell you anything about what Shakespeare is or why Shakespeare is interesting or important. Everything that's important in Shakespeare happens psychologically. It happens in characters' moments of reckoning with themselves and with others. It very rarely happens in actions or events.
So, and can you kind of summarize what Shakespeare is all about then?
Shakespeare's all about ourselves. To read Shakespeare's plays deeply and fully is to go in and encounter every emotion you've ever felt, both the ones you want to own up to and the ones you don't want to own up to. When Hamlet says that the actors should hold a mirror up to nature, in a way, that's exactly what Shakespeare's doing. He's holding a mirror up to human nature.
Professor Linda Charnas, thank you so much for coming in and being on An Interchange.
Thank you very much for having me, Dave. It's always a pleasure to talk about Shakespeare.
Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is Chad Crothers. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. Music in the breaks by Kaleem Jamal. And please stay tuned for House of Jazz with Tillman, coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.